and welcome to the A-Level Politics Show. I'm working my way through some of your wonderful suggestions on which show to produce, and one request that has been made time and time again is to record an episode on the EU. Now, the specification was deliberately amended when the UK left the EU as a result of Brexit, following the 2016 referendum and through to the subsequent EU Withdrawal Act that saw the country leave on the 31st of January 2020. The focus of the spec is now split between how Brexit has affected sovereignty, see episode 102 for that peeps, and whether the aims of the EU have been met. It is the latter question to which we pay our attention to today. The question is this: evaluate the view that the EU has met its aims. So clearly, we need to decide what its aims are. There are a lot of aims. The specification, though, specifically mentions three. One, the four freedoms of the single market and whether those freedoms have been successful, are completed. Two, political union. And three, economic union. Now, there are several other aims that link to these three, such as promoting peace and EU enlargement. I will cover these within the wide analysis of the three mentioned in the spec. There are a number of tips I would recommend for answering this question. One, use lots of key terms. Don't worry, I'll help define them as we go, such as veto and the Schengen area, etc. Two, use recent examples, such as the impact of the war on Ukraine, responses to immigration and COVID policy. Three, show some understanding of the political institutions. You don't have to know the ins and outs of how, say, the European Commission works, but just to reference it is pretty useful. And four, for perceptive analysis, that's level five, AO2. Understand A, that sometimes the aims are in conflict with one another. For example, EU enlargement could affect political union as it is difficult to reach joint decisions in a larger club. And B, refer to conservative and liberal views of the EU. More on that later. Finally, C, a bit of nuance is fine. The aims of the EU may not have been reached, but a liberal approach might be to argue that the EU project is a work in progress to an ever closer union, while a conservative might say attempts at political union are a power grab by faceless bureaucrats in Brussels at the expense of national sovereignty and decision making. Full disclosure here, I used to work for the EU in the European Commission's press office in London. Now, as someone who has worked for the European Commission, the de facto executive of the EU, which proposes laws and checks to see if member states comply with them once approved, I can honestly debunk the myth of a Leviathan-like monster seizing power. The opposite was true in my opinion. The EU is often paralysed by indecision. That is why the direction of my essay is that the EU has indeed not yet achieved its aims. The rise of populists and the right wing will make that even more difficult in the years to come. Right, let's get on with the show. First up is coverage of the four freedoms and an understanding of what they mean. Now, I'm going to use a bit of persuasive language here right at the start. There are those who mistakenly suggest. Now, the word mistakenly is great because it's indicating that you disagree with this view, even though you're going to develop it. So you're getting AO3 evaluation marks there. So here we go. There are those who mistakenly suggest that the aims of the four freedoms of the single market have been met because the EU is by some measure the world's biggest single market between multiple countries. The EU was indeed established in 1957 to integrate the economies of Germany and France, two countries who went to war with each other three times between 1870 and 1945. The idea was to promote the view of Frederick Bastiat, who said that if goods do not cross borders, armies will, i.e. the more closed your economy is to outside influence, the more likely you will see those outside influences as threats. World War II was partly caused by harmful protectionism, where countries shut out other countries from trade, resulting in a lack of economic integration between countries. You're not going to go to war with a country that you economically rely on, so the argument followed. The six founding countries aimed for what was called an ever closer union and promoted, along with many other countries that joined thereafter, a single market that would eventually be created across the continent in order to facilitate this integration. The single market would be underpinned by four freedoms. One, the free movement of goods, or what we might call a customs union, to ensure that individuals and businesses could freely trade with one another without barriers such as taxes and tariffs placed on imports from countries within the EU. So if I want to sell my DVDs, ask your parents what those are, I can flog them to a Spanish guy in Bilbao and there will be no additional taxes imposed on me just because I happen to be from France. I would say Britain, but Britain's no longer part of the EU. You have free movement of services, and this is the ability of a business in one country to establish itself in another. It also involves the recognition of qualifications. For example, a trained hairdresser in Sweden should not be turned away from opening a salon in France. Three, the free movement of capital. That's the free flow of money, the ability to set up a bank account in different EU countries, for example. And four, the free movement of people, the ability of people to work, study and live across the EU with full citizenship rights, including access to benefits. Now, in many ways, these four freedoms and by extension, the single market has been achieved. It's been completed. That was the whole aim, to complete a single market. The Single European Act 1985 was designed to remove barriers to trade, including customs controls by 1992, facilitating the free movement of goods. This increased economic growth. In 2022, the GDP of the EU was worth about 18 trillion euros, by some accounts the second largest economy in the world after the US. The EU counts 15% of global trade. We see that free movement of people is guaranteed by EU law that allows people from different member states who marry each other, say, to live and work in whichever EU member state they choose to live in. Your spouse can move and live with you. We see the single market working regarding free movement of people with the Erasmus scheme, an EU-backed program that supports student exchanges. The lifting of borders through the Schengen Agreement has allowed the free flow of goods and people to cross borders on a daily basis, reducing barriers to trade and promoting the free movement of people. The Schengen Agreement ensures that the countries have no borders between themselves, have no passport controls, facilitating that free movement of goods and people. However, and I'm going to say however for a second time, as I usually do, and maybe a third, however, despite these gains, the aims of the single market have not been met since there is not complete free movement of goods, services, capital and people. Some sectors of national economies are closed off to businesses in other member states. The free market in energy and digital services, for example, is not complete. The European Commission, which is kind of like the executive, the government, if you like, of the European Union, which proposes laws and checks to see that those laws are being enforced, has had to take a number of member states to the European Court of Justice, which is the body that adjudicates on single market compliance, for failing to adhere to single market rules. According to the European Commission's single market scorecard, Greece had 44 infringement proceedings brought against it for failing to comply with single market rules as of December 2023. Spain, France, Hungary, Ireland, and Italy are also in the red for failing to introduce single market rules in different sectors of their economies. That is, they're not complying very much. In relation to the free movement of people, we see that immigration and migrant flows have had a real impact on support for Schengen, with temporary restrictions placed on free movement in 2015 after a large flow of refugees from Syria made their way across the continent fleeing civil war. Not all countries signed up to Schengen and free movement. Several member states, including the UK at the time of its signing in 1995, kept permanent border controls. Ireland, Bulgaria and Croatia are other states who have not signed up. The resulting controversy over free movement has helped populist right-wing leaders to assume power. In Poland, until the recent electoral loss of the Law and Justice Party, in Italy, under the premiership of Giorgia Meloni, and in Hungary, under Viktor Orban. These movements have arguably curtailed further calls for free movement and further single market integration. The prospect of a far-right victory in the French presidential election in 2027 could spell the death knell for the EU and its call for ever closer union. Brexit, perhaps, was the starting gun, since it was arguably decided by anti-migrant sentiment stemming from free movement of Eastern European workers to the UK. Thus, the single market is under strain. Its four freedoms have not been fully achieved, and in particular, the freedom of labour is coming under fire in multiple member states. Okay, so the second aim we are going to examine is this aim of economic and monetary union. Now, granted, I love that word again because it's acknowledging another side of the argument without agreeing with it. Granted, there is some evidence that the EU's goal of economic union has been achieved. The Maastricht Treaty in 1993 committed member states to monetary union, whereby they would eventually, in 1999, adopt the single currency, the euro. Multiple national currencies with a variety of interest rates and central banks steering different economic courses was to be replaced by one European central bank to set interest rates for the whole eurozone and one currency. The idea was to ensure a more stable currency and to facilitate trade, banking and lending across states that were not subject, that was not subject to a myriad of different rates of interest and sudden price changes as a result of currency fluctuations, as was the picture before the euro was introduced. There are currently 20 member states who have adopted the euro. It is the world's second reserve currency after the dollar. 341 million people use the euro every day. Adopting the euro has resulted in stable interest rates, and also it has meant that consumers have more transparency in buying goods and services across countries since it is easier to understand the price. However, adopting the euro has not necessarily promoted the economic growth that the EU desired and has resulted in economic hardship in some member states. Several countries did not adopt the euro at the start, hindering the impact of its introduction. A number of countries in southern Europe, especially Greece, Italy, Spain and Portugal, struggled to meet the criteria for joining and staying in the euro, especially the requirement to reduce debt. These attempts resulted in harsh cuts in public spending, which has further limited support for the economic union. The credit crunch laid bare the unsustainable requirements of EU of euro membership. Several countries required a bailout from the European Central Bank. Greece had to accept severe austerity in return. The experience weakened the enthusiasm for joining the eurozone. Even new members such as Hungary and the Czech Republic refrained from doing so, along with long-standing members such as Sweden. The ECB has come under fire in the past for firstly keeping interest rates too high after the credit crunch and then not raising them fast enough to stave off inflation after the COVID pandemic. Eurozone growth in 2024 is flat at best, with its most important member, Germany, the economic powerhouse of the EU, in recession. These examples have dampened support for further monetary union. Let's now turn to the third and final aim, political union. Now, arguably, this aim has been realised, as it has become the EU, that is, a diplomatic player on the world stage. It has promoted peace and created institutions that facilitate democracy and joint decision-making on areas of common interest. As a result of several treaties, the EU now has an executive, the European Commission, a Court of Appeal, the European Court of Justice, and a democratically elected legislature in the European Parliament. The EU decision-making process is highly consultative, with a Council of Ministers allowing national governments a say on whether EU proposals get the go-ahead. It has sought to balance this consultation and local or national decision-making, what some might call subsidiarity, with deepening political union. The Nice Treaty removed areas where member states could block proposals by applying a national veto. The Lisbon Treaty furthered the EU's diplomatic clout by creating the post of EU President and High Representative for Foreign Affairs. These two new roles sought to harmonise EU foreign policy and allow the bloc to speak with one voice. The Russia invasion of Ukraine in 2022 saw the European Commission President promise future membership to a free Ukraine, stating that the future of Ukraine was in our union. The bloc imposed the strictest sanctions in its history on Russia and promised military support. Political union is also expressed through a commitment to social union and political rights. The Charter of Fundamental Rights has been entrenched into EU law. Every member state must apply its civil liberties into domestic law. The social chapter has sought to further employee rights, such as the right for part-time workers to receive the same benefits and protections as full-time workers, the right to maternity and paternity leave, the maximum working hours directive, what we call the EU Working Time Directive, that banned employers from compelling employees from working longer than 48 hours. Political union was also supposed to ensure the EU could take up causes that affected every member state and respond in such a way that would be beneficial and at scale. In 2022, the EU pledged almost 2 trillion euros to help with COVID recovery, for example. Political union also aimed to expand the union through EU enlargement to former Soviet countries and beyond, with 10 new countries joining in 2004 and others such as Bulgaria, Romania and Croatia joining later on. By doing so, political union sought to spread democracy to countries that have been under communist control. Several countries are performing well with regards to openness and transparency since joining the EU, which is indicative of the democratizing effect that political union aimed for. Slovenia, for example, has been given a 96 out of 100 rating by Freedom House, a democracy monitoring group. Now, that's higher than the UK that has 91 out of 100. Yet political union is under serious threat, as well as many of its subsidiary aims, such as promoting peace, fostering common responses to crises, and promoting democracy. The institutions of the EU are too cumbersome for liberals, who argue that greater political union is what is needed. For them, not enough sovereignty has been pooled. Too much power still lies in the hands of national governments who seek to block change. The EU migrant deal, reached in December 2023, took years in the making. According to refugee groups, it has largely been shaped in response to populist anti-immigration sentiment, rather than by carefully thought-out policies that combine managing migration flows with humane treatment of asylum seekers. For conservatives, meanwhile, the EU political institutions are highly undemocratic, take away sovereignty from member states and place too much power in the unelected elements, the European Commission, the ECJ, the ECB, rather than the elected institutions, the European Parliament. The bloc is far from speaking in one with one voice on the world stage. Defence spending varies widely, and only some countries have responded to the call to help provide military assistance to Ukraine. France and Poland are calling for import controls on Ukrainian wheat after protests by farmers in those countries, while other countries want to maintain this important economic lifeline for Ukraine to pay for fighting Russia. Democracy is going backwards in some member states. Poland, ranked only 80 out of 100 by Freedom House, curbed the independence of the judiciary, and Orbán's Hungary has clamped down on freedom of the press. Former Soviet countries such as Estonia are under threat from far-right movements opposed to EU rules and from Russian interference. Bulgaria has suffered similar assaults on democracy, with discrimination against ethnic minorities, and is only ranked 78 out of 100 by Freedom House. The project, therefore, to widen political union through enlarging the club has stalled. In 2020, the UK left the EU. The future membership of applicant countries such as Turkey and Serbia remains in doubt, given the geopolitical uncertainty and the doubts about the rule of law in those wishing to join. Thus, the EU has not yet achieved its aims. The single market is incomplete, despite the huge strides that have been made thus far. Free movement of labour is a particular issue, since it is bound up in debates at national level over immigration. Economic union appears to have stalled also. The euro has not proved to be the panacea for economic malaise. Regarding political union, there has been some deepening with reforms of the EU institutions and some widening with EU enlargement, but the wider goals of a common foreign and defence policy, of peaceful coexistence, of working to provide joint solutions to common problems, of facilitating the spread of democracy, have stalled as well in recent years. That's not to say the ambition is wrong or that it can't someday be achieved. But first, the populists, the demagogues, the vacillators and naysayers must all be overcome. And that's some tall task. I hope you found this episode useful. Thanks so much for listening. And if you don't already, why not subscribe to Plus? For just £1.99 a month, you get access to the full back catalogue of A-Level Politics shows, plus the transcripts in Spotify. Oh, and plus 2 bonus pods per month. No wonder why we call it Plus. And you can cancel anytime. Deets are in the show notes. Until the next time, take care. Bye.